Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder of The New Health Club. If you want to know about psychedelics as new mental health tools, you came to the right place. I talk to innovators, thought leaders and disruptors, creating the future of mental health and mental wellness. And we think that the future is already here. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of The New Health Club Show. My guest today is Paul Stamets. If you haven't heard of him already, Paul is an American mycologist and entrepreneur, somebody who's really in the know about mushrooms. And Paul is an author and advocate of the medicinal fungi. Stamets runs Fungi Perfecti, a family-owned, environmentally friendly company specializing in using mushrooms to improve the health of the planet and its people. Fungi Perfecti has become synonymous with cutting-edge mycological research and innovative mycological solutions. Paul was talking about these mycological solutions already for years, and since the movie Fantastic Fungi that everybody should watch, one could call Stamets the emperor of mushrooms. At least we can do it here. And yes, also magic mushrooms that changed Paul's life long time ago. He often talks about his experience with magic mushrooms, and he's pretty well known for his mushrooms microdosing protocol. But Paul is not a big fan of using magic mushrooms in any other way than thoughtfully and purposeful, and he doesn't like the word shrooms at all. Paul is an incredible mind, an incredible entrepreneur, a perfect guest with millions of stories, and one of them is that Stamets once was the German name Steinmetz from Bavaria. And of course, we ended our conversation with me promising Paul to look for his ancestors in Bavaria. Other than that, this whole conversation is just about mushrooms. Please enjoy the show and Paul. Paul, of course, we're super excited to have you finally on this show. And as I learned from Joe Rogan, you're one of the most requested people on the internet. So it's a big honor to have you, not only because of this, but also because I think you have a large fan community in Europe now in the meantime. So why don't we just quickly start with your kind of current achievement, the Fungi Perfecti project, which you describe as building a bridge between people and fungi. So maybe you just talk about this for a warm up.
Okay. Well, I typically don't talk about my company. But I've been involved in the study of fungi for all my life. It's literally, I was attracted to the forbidden fruit, which is mushrooms. There's a lot of misunderstandings and misinformation about mushrooms, you know, through folklore, through prejudices, what we call also mycophobia, the irrational fear of fungi. And Eastern Europe is very mycophilic, and indeed in France and Germany. But in England, it's very mycophobic. And, and in Asia, typically mushrooms are looking upon as being rejuvenation, renewal, something springing from the ground, decomposition. And the British saw fungi as being, you know, representations of decomposition and death and destruction and disease. And unfortunately, that permeated into the medical community, because the medical community is greatly influenced by the English. And so the concept of fungi were bad is permeated even to this day throughout the medical institutions, where physicians are taught that fungi are pathogens that cause disease. But I challenge any physician, I've never met a physician that had, besides Saccharomyces cerevisiae making beer or bread, there has been no courses ever that I've ever heard in the medical schools talking about the benefits of mushrooms. It's always that fungi cause disease and not about how fungi and particularly mushrooms can help immunity. We do, it's very well taught that fungi are a source of antibiotics, so, and antibiotic drugs to fight bacteria. But fungi beyond that has always been viewed as representation of disease. So that's part of the forbidden fruit concept. So the great thing about our societies, especially today, is that we benefit from multi-ethnicity. And what that means is that there's ethnic knowledge, you know, from North Africa, you know, from Russia, you know, from France. And when you have multi-ethnicities coming together, they come together with their specialized knowledge of mushrooms from their homeland. And so there's long traditions that go on for centuries. Some families have mushroom patches that have been in their family, you know, in France in particular, I know, and in Italy, that are their secret, sacred mushroom patches that they protect and it's part of their family heritage. And indeed, you know, many of the elder people I've met, their greatest memories are being as a child, walking with their grandparents, hunting truffles, hunting chanterelles. So it's part of the family culture. But moreover, it's not the family culture, it's a community culture. And so having this inputs of knowledge has really put us into a unique circumstance today where there is a worldwide awakening of the value of mushrooms across the planet. Because I believe habitats have immune systems, just like we do. And mycelium is a cellular bridge that joins us together. And since fungi create soils, and healthier soils lead to greater biodiversity, biodiversity is biosecurity, which means that fungi are the keystone species for biosecurity in the ecosystem. By engaging fungi, we end up building the health of the soils that lead to the biodiversity that leads to homeostasis. And the more species we have, the more skill sets each species has to be able to bring to the forefront should there be a challenge or threat to the commons, to the community of organisms that are created guilds to cooperate together to have a healthy ecosystem that benefits us all.
So basically, the whole, let's say, mycological society is coming, you could say. And I mean, just before that, we don't forget this, everybody should watch this amazing movie, Fantastic Fungi, about you, where you explain this in a much bigger sense. And it's also animated. And I mean, I watched it twice because it was so interesting what kind of, like how our systems are all affected by mushrooms, you could say. But of course, you also talk in this movie about your first magic mushroom experience and how it really changed you and your whole, I mean, your whole person, basically. So it would be great if you could just talk a little bit about that, how you got in touch with magic mushrooms first and how it really changed you as a person.
Well, I always like to give credit to my older brother, John. He's since has passed away. But my brother John went to Mexico and South America. They went to Yale College, Yale University. And so when he came back from Yale, talking about his vacation to Mexico in South America, eating magic mushrooms, I was the youngest of five children. And so my brother was, he's the oldest brother. So I adored him, idolized him. So when he came back with these fantastic stories of eating magic mushrooms in the mountains of Mesoamerica, I was just entranced. And so we grew up in a fairly large house in Ohio. My father was an industrialist, but we had a complete laboratory in the basement. I'm talking about five rows of chemicals. My brother John went on to Yale to study in chemistry. He was a serious scientist. He would kind of park me in the corner and I could play. But he did his serious work, but he banished me from the laboratory experiments. But my father was on the USS Intrepid aircraft carrier during World War II. And after World War II, he got the Intrepid aircraft carrier radio. And so we had this radio and I put up about I'll speak in meters, about a 75 to 100 meter long antenna, being glass insulators between trees. And I listened to coded messages on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And so I was all these spy communications from East Germany, you know, and from Russia. And I was just mesmerized by this. So I was sitting in the laboratory all the time and my brother would let me play with the radio. And so I was fascinated by that environment. Then my brother went on to Yale, and then I inherited the laboratory, and now I had free reign and to do anything.
Wow.
And I looked up every experiment that said danger, do not bring near flame, because I wanted to build rockets and to explode things. And my dream is to have a laboratory complex and being a scientist. And now I'm living my dream. I have very large laboratories now. We produce mycelium in mushrooms, but we grow about 50 to 100,000 kilos of mycelium a week. I have about 700 strains of fungi in my culture library. I'm very passionate about going into endangered ecosystems and taking samples. Oftentimes, it's about the tenth the size of my little fingernail is all I need, so I don't have to harvest the mushrooms. I just take a little piece of them, and I get them into the laboratory, and I culture them. So I'm looking at screening our laboratory strains for potential immunologically beneficial properties, upregulating the immune system. And I've been long involved in antiviral testing of my mushroom strain.
Okay. But I mean, like, it seems that coming quickly back to the magic ones, they seem to have convinced you as a whole, like, human being to open yourself up even more to mushrooms, right? Or like your experience with that.
You know, it's a subject that the more I think one discusses and understands it, the more depth that there is. It had an enormous influence on me. I had a very serious stuttering habit, stammering. If any of you have seen the movie The King's Speech, that was the degree of my stuttering, or maybe even worse. And there are studies now, over 44 universities in the United States and in Europe are doing clinical studies on psilocybin. And the type of stuttering that I had, and I still do stutter a little bit, but it's 99% it's resolved. And it came from this very intense magic mushroom experience. And my stuttering really resolved directly after that experience in 6 hours. And this is the interesting thing is that, and now I have a better understanding just recently, and I'll explain why. But the type of stuttering that I had, and many of you out there, if you meet a stutterer, don't finish their sentences. Please don't make fun of them. That's cruel. Why are you making fun of a stutterer? You know, that's just, you're being an asshole, you know? It tells us a lot more about you than about the person you're trying to make fun of. But the type of stuttering I had, I would not stutter to animals. I was fluent in talking to my dogs or my turtles or any pet, my cat. Did not stutter when you sang a song. Only stuttered when I talked to people.
Okay.
And so now we have just unveiled a microdose.me app, an app. You can go to microdose.me. It's an app for microdosing. And we have two peer articles that we're submitting to peer-reviewed medical journals. And we have astonishingly powerful results. There's over 4,000 non-microdosers in the study, 4,000 active microdosers, a pretty good parity of populations. And this is all blinded. Now we've unmasked the data. Again, microdose.me, it's a free app for the iPhone, not for the Droid yet. We have thousands of people participating, but we looked at depression, anxiety, and mood. And astonishing results show that microdosing with dried mushrooms, mostly Psilocybe cubensis, the mushrooms are most commonly sold in Europe and in the United States, in the underground, so to speak. And the microdosing of this significantly reduced anxiety, reduced depression, increased mood. Now, just not if you know about p-values, these p-values aren't just less than 0.05. We're looking at extraordinarily high significance. And the anxiety one, to me, showed me something that I realized. My stuttering was because of social anxiety. I would get hung up on a word. I'd be too self-reflective. I was worried about people making a judgment on me. When I start to stutter, there's more judgment. I stuttered more judgment, you know, and it's a spiral into the abyss. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to get out of it. So I realized that my heroic dose on psilocybin and then this data that we have from microdosing substantially reduces anxiety. Mm-hmm. And the other message that I got is that I'm a good person. I really am a good person. I looked at my soul and I realized, you're okay, Paul. You know, love yourself. And knowing that it doesn't matter what people think of you. It matters what you think of yourself. You know, are you a person that you admire? Can you be a better person? Can you raise your expectations to be a more generous, kinder, intelligent, compassionate person? If you know that every time you move that goalpost, you get closer and better to that new goalpost and you become a better person, then that elevates you, literally. It elevates you into a higher state of consciousness. And I realize it doesn't matter what other people think. It's what I think internally. Am I doing the right thing? And when I reframed for my heroic dose of psilocybin, and now we know now from the microdosing studies, so a lot of us are now subscribing to the philosophy, and again, this is a hypothesis of therapeutic use, occasional heroic doses of psilocybin, and then afterwards microdosing. Because at Johns Hopkins, for instance, in one of the clinical studies using psilocybin, the pure molecule, 14 months later, when people re-remembered the experience, it turned out to be therapeutically beneficial from the memory. So right. A lot of people suffering from PTSD, when they had these therapeutic doses of psilocybin, they could resolve a lot of these issues they've had. Very commonly said, these issues were bigger issues than they needed to be. Having gone through this spiritual experience on psilocybin, they came to a resolution, they put it in perspective. And then because they put it into resolution, that experience was very positive. So they had a memory of that positive therapeutic dose and experience. And by re-remembering it, it was therapeutically beneficial more than a year or 2 years later. Well, similarly, what is your memory? Well, your memory is neurological pathways that are resonant, that re-spark, and that's how we remember things. So if you have a heroic dose of psilocybin, you have this therapeutically beneficial event. It neurologically becomes entrained, resident, you know, within your brain, within your own neurology. And then when you cognitively re-remember it, just like microdosing re-stimulates these neurological pathways, a lot of us now are thinking that, wow, microdosing may really work because it reinvigorates the pathways that led to a positive reckoning, a positive therapeutic response. So it's not only re-remembering it, you know, in your mind psychologically, but it's re-stimulating the same neurological pathways through microdosing where the breakthrough experience, you know, paved the way. And now we are on that path again through microdosing. So we think the two go together, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You're re-remembering the experience, and neurologically, by re-remembering, you're activating the same neurological pathways that gave resonance to that memory.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And it's an interesting new approach also to it, I feel. And I mean, obviously, like, there's James Fadiman's protocol for microdosing LSD, and this is the one well-known protocol, but yours for microdosing psilocybin is the other, in the meantime, pretty well-known. So maybe you can talk a little bit about your protocol that you developed.
Well, Jim and I are good friends, and Jim and I, you know, we talk to each other, and we're making educated guesses. You know, we have reasons for saying what we do. They're based on science. I am suggesting on the Psilocybe cubensis scale, the most commonly grown psilocybe mushrooms available in the world that can be grown all year round. At 1% psilocybin, that's about 10 milligrams. And I am suggesting 1/10 of 1 gram of psilocybin mushrooms, about 1 milligram or less of psilocybin. That's below the threshold of experience. By definition, a microdose means you don't feel it. You take some psilocybin mushrooms and you feel it, even a small amount, if you feel it, that's not a microdose. That is an effective dose to change your consciousness. It's known as subsensorium, below the threshold of you being able to sense. So you take a subsensorium dose. From my experience, it's 1/10 of a gram or less. James Fadiman recommends up to 0.4 grams. I think that the mushrooms he was getting were not that potent. So he ate more. I think his protocol is a little bit higher than mine. You do normalize. So if you did feel a liftoff dose and you took the same amount the next day, it'd be less and less, you know, progressively, you know, on consecutive days. But James recommends it 1 day on, 2 days off, 1 day on. I'm suggesting 4 days on to 5 days on, you know, break on the weekend, whatever you want to, Monday through Fridays, take Saturday and Sunday off, or Monday through Thursdays, take Friday, Saturday and Sunday is off. So this is obviously not used for partying. So for the rave scene, this is contraindicated for the rave community. Yeah. They think they were microdosing during the weekends. The idea is to watch the receptors so they renormalize. And then there's a stimulus response relationship. But we have very good evidence right now. And if you've seen my talks recently, I have one at MAPS. And I talk about, you can see all the data tables, the research that we've done with neurogenesis, with psilocybin analogs, talking about the stimulation of psilocybin analogs in causing neurogenesis, brain neurons to regrow. Substantially similar to that of what's called BDNF, brain-derived nerve factors. And this is the golden standard for looking at neurogenesis. So compared to baseline, we're able to stimulate neurons to regrow over a period of about 7 to 12 days. This also fits into microdosing. Heroic dose of psilocybin is for six hours. How many new neurons do you build in 6 hours? I suggest to you, not very many, compared to how many neurons do you build in a week. So, you know, neurogenesis, it means cell divisions. So the more time you have for cell divisions downstream, the more proliferation there is. So the idea with neurogenesis, I think psilocybin builds intelligence. I think psilocybin mushrooms are Einstein mushrooms. Psilocybin mushrooms will increase your intelligence. And we need more intelligent, more compassionate, more empathetic, more kinder people on this planet. I mean, who is against that? I made that statement exactly as I stated. And about 20,000 people said they agreed, but 8 people said they disagreed.
The FDA, you mean?
Who are the 8 people who do not want to become more intelligent?
Now we have another way to convince them. But I mean, so are you saying that, let's say the hero dose or the big dose psilocybin that you might have in a guided retreat situation, you might say it's preparing your brain for microdosing much better. Could you say that? I mean, is that a theory?
And I also think just re-remembering the experience in and of itself, because you feel a joy and compassion. But that re-remembering is activating the same neurological pathways by nurturing those pathways with microdosing. You support neurologically neurogenesis, the creation and the structure. We're all losing a lot of neurons every day, and we're always repairing them and growing more. It was thought that the entire brain was wired up until adolescence and you built no new neurons. Well, that theory has been thrown out. So clearly, you know, we can regenerate brain neurons. Mm-hmm. And it looks like these psilocybin analogs are particularly powerful. And this also means that psilocybin mushrooms with these analogs could benefit you because they have the entourage effect, whereas psilocybin as a pure molecule does not have the entourage effect. It might give you the experience, but we are very deep in doing research showing that the entourage effect of the psilocybin and psilocybin analogs fundamentally increase your neurogenesis compared to psilocybin by itself.
Okay, wow, interesting.
So the natural product may be better than the pure molecule.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that it's a spiritual plant, the magic mushroom?
You know, I have 7 books out, but my one book, Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World, you know, that I wrote in 1996, you know, I said at the end of the foreword, there is no doubt in my mind that these are spiritual medicines.
Mm-hmm.
But moreover, I see a convergence of science and spirituality. I am not religious, but I am deeply spiritual. Who could not be spiritual looking at the extent of the galaxies and the universe and the billions of stars and planets? The more that we study nature, the more that we realize how vast it is, and that you, Anne, and I are just temporarily a molecular configuration of stardust that have come together in this form. And we're speaking now, but we're going to disambiguate. We're going to fall apart. Our molecules are going to stream back into the abyss mm-hmm. from which we sprang. I think that's not a bad thing. I think that's the way of nature and the way of existence. Mm-hmm. And the more that we recognize, you know, the way of our existence is a natural phenomenon, then when we lose a loved one, and I've lost some dear loved ones, I lost my brother, I lost my mother, I lost my father. I was by my father's side when he died. And my father was in a coma. And then at 2 a.m, I was beside his bed. I was the only one in his bed in the hospital. And he was unconscious for 3 or 4 days. And at the moment of death, and some of your listeners have seen this, if you've watched someone pass, at the moment of his death, his eyes opened up.
Mm-hmm.
He arched his back. It's hard to describe this, but his eyes went blue with like a blue light. They shined. And for about 5 seconds, he awoke. You know, he didn't have consciousness necessarily, but his eyes got bright. He arched his back and then he died. That shook me to my core. And then I realized this is why people believe in spirit. When you witness something like that, you know. And then he was just a body. He was no longer my dad.
Mm-hmm.
He was now a dead body. And when I saw that experience, it really made me wonder, where did he go?
Yeah, it's a question. I mean, even if you're not religious, it's a question. Where do people go?
Yeah, what happened
after this? Yeah.
So I feel more reconciled now because of my doses with psilocybin. There's the unity with one giant consciousness mm-hmm. to realize that you're part of this enormous oneness, and it's greeting you with open arms. It has enormous, enormous wisdom and knowledge. It's based on the power of goodness and kindness. I believe the universe is kind, and our existence is part of this one unanimity of consciousness. And I think that we just have a very thin understanding and slice of what that is. And as a result, we're provincial, we're ignorant, we're uneducated. We don't have the word skills, the language to be able to explain this.
Mm.
It's beyond our ability to communicate the vastness of the idea that we enter into. And when you enter into the mycoverse, which I call the mycoverse, you enter into this giant landscape that you realize is all around us all the time, and that we all exist vibrantly together. It's just that we reassimilate in different forms. Anyhow, all right.
Well, it's very powerful what you're saying. It's very interesting to look at it that way. I mean, so that means also that this kind of thinking will have more room actually now, since we, after the election, we had so many states in the U.S. opening up to kind of to a different approach to it. You could almost say like plant medicine, including cannabis too. So, and there were so many articles saying the war on drugs is on the way out. Like the drugs are the winner of this election. So, which is a nice thought. But so how do you feel about this? Does, I mean, after this time in America that was looking at it from Europe, I mean, I was there 2016, but then I left, and it seems like a very repressed atmosphere these 4 years.
I represent the majority of Americans and sending our sincere apologies.
Okay, good.
We apologize. We are so sorry.
It's
this
okay.
This is not the best of America.
We know that. I love America. I mean,
this is not the way you want your children to behave.
No.
And this is the great contradiction that hurts us. You know, just it hurts our soul. How can these Christians who espouse all the golden rule, do unto others as you wish them to do to you, to be kind, to give forgiveness, how could we have a leader that is supported by the Christian movement? Mm-hmm. It is totally hypocritical. It's antithetical to their basic belief. Our country was torn apart. Mm-hmm. And I personally, and people can disagree with me, I'm happy that people disagree with me. We all are entitled to our own opinions. I feel like this is the last gasp. And if I use a football analogy, it's called the Hail Mary pass of the sexist, misogynistic, white male dominated society that was fearful of change, fearful of the technological revolution, the revolution in gay rights, the revolution in recognizing the importance of ethnic diversity and mm-hmm. the respect for all peoples. And so I think the old paradigm foundations, and older people have more money than younger people, they were trying to hold on to those structures mm-hmm. that were basically threatened with extinction. And so I think this was a Hail Mary pass, a last gasp. And oh my God, they actually crossed the finish line and they elected this past president. But I think it's a lesson on not how to act. So I think the pendulum will swing. Mm-hmm. And I think as we have an opportunity to be able to regain our principles that are based on Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Jewish tenets, all those religions hold in common the same central principles of kindness and forgiveness and the golden rule. And so I hope it's our time. And that's why I think the use of psychedelics and psilocybin, it crosses political lines, because what's happened in the United States is the addiction to opioids mm-hmm. Has been devastating. Far right Republican senators, congressmen, congresswomen have relatives or children that have been affected by the opioid crisis. And they know the war on drugs has not worked. And to see that such a powerful medicine, and just yesterday I heard a lecture from Johns Hopkins with a 66% success rate in breaking cigarette addiction.
All right.
Mm-hmm. One psilocybin session. Mm-hmm. With nicotine being one of the most addictive drugs ever, and nothing comes close to this. One psilocybin session has a 66% likelihood of you being tobacco free for more than 2 years. That's phenomenal.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And the same that we're seeing with other addictive substances. And it's because it allows the brain to renormalize prior to this addictive state. And then if you can capitalize on that with a therapist who's trained, and especially therapy, with many of us who are not as traumatized, you know, we can do a lot of self-therapy. We understand, you know, how to resolve our issues. May not be as major as those issues that people who have been traumatized through rape, war, PTSD of anything, they need extra help. And having a guided professional therapist, I think, results in a much higher probability of successful outcome. Mm-hmm. So, but this is why I think the revolution and the legalization or decriminalization of psychedelics has gained so much traction, is the medical community is looking at this objectively as fact-based medicine. What does the data show? Put all your prejudices on psychedelics off to the side. Look at the pure data. Then without prejudice, look at the data and see the outcomes. Anyone without prejudice, you know, in the medical community, the scientific community, it looks at the end results, you know, and it's very, very clear that these are some of the most powerfully effective medicines that have ever been discovered.
But do you think a nation can be traumatized? Do you think that?
Okay, you're from Europe, so I plead my ignorance, okay? But yeah.
You're fine.
Okay, so I'm sure you can vilify for me. You can vilify me on this.
No.
I went to Slovenia. Mm-hmm. I love Slovenia. Mm-hmm. Slovenia is mostly forested, thanks to this amazing queen. When the villages all burned down in the capital of Slovenia, she passed an edict that all the houses thereafter have to be built of stone. And so this is like hundreds of years ago. So as a result, the forests were not cut down, right? So Slovenia is heavily forested. Slovenia is as a population, a very happy people. I went to Croatia.
Mm.
And Croatia is a country that's been traumatized.
Mm.
You know, it was clearly evident to me that the people were traumatized. You go into any community that has been traumatized by war, then you have generational effects of trauma where the parents are traumatized. They can reflect their trauma back onto their children. You have generational trauma.
Sure.
And if you're abused by a child, when you're a child and you're abused, and this is so clear, especially in my own life, I've had very dear friends and loved ones. You know, one of my ex-partners was abused when she was a child, and she grew up to be an abuser. And so I can see this pattern of abuse. It becomes multi-generational. By mm-hmm. breaking that pattern of abuse, mm-hmm. you not only save that person, but downstream family members, your descendants, and then not only your family, but your neighbors, not only your neighbors, but your community. Not your community, but your country. And so I think this is literally a solution from the underground that enters into these families who are suffering trauma and can be paradigm shifting for preventing multi-generational abuse.
But there was even a webinar shortly before the elections, I think from Harvard, and the topic was, can psychedelics save America? So your answer is yes, right? I mean, I assume.
Well, I think I have great hope that microdosing with psilocybin will become a vitamin mm-hmm. that people take mm-hmm. Frequently, because we all suffer from dementia. We all, unfortunately, lose our mental acumen, you know, our cognitive decline with age is just a fact of life. Mm-hmm. That's why I think psilocybin is an Einstein molecule. I think we already know it builds neurons and the psilocybin analogs, and we already know it increases cognition.
Mm-hmm.
We have very increasingly good evidence that it can fundamentally improve your mental health. And when you have less anxiety, you have less depression, you're in a better mood, you're more creative. Right. And when you're more creative, you're working on an art project, you're writing a new book, you're doing something, you're building a house, whatever, and you're creative, the next morning when you wake up, you want to get back to your creative enterprise. Mm-hmm. You're excited, mm-hmm. you're happier. So creativity leads to happiness. And if you are not depressed and don't have anxiety, and you're in a better mood, you're more creative. If you're more creative, you're happier. If you're happier, you're more creative, and you're in a better mood. So I think it's truly a binary fork in your progression of your life.
So you're saying it's entering soon in the group of vitamins where we don't, if you would microdose with psilocybin in the way that you wouldn't feel it, like you said earlier. So, but you could use the benefits of microdosing without being on a psychedelic, basically.
That's true. Now, to be a contrarian to my own philosophy, there is a concern about heart valve interference with the 5-HTA mm-hmm. and 2B receptor. The idea is that there's another drug that interferes with that, and that could lead to a heart valve disease condition. Mm-hmm. That has been suggested as a potential negative consequence, but there's no evidence of that yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one's ever reported it. They just mm-hmm. theoretically report it because of another drug that activates the same receptors, and they would thought that this could be a heart valve disease. So it's good to have a precautionary attitude towards this, but we have thousands of people in our microdose study. No one's reporting any heart issues. So it may be a fact without significance, if you know what I mean. As mm-hmm. a factually mm-hmm. correct, high doses, yes, with some people. But microdosing is so low in the amount that you're taking by definition. I think that we'll eventually come to a very specified amount over time as the science progresses.
Okay. Well, I mean, we could, of course, talk for hours, but I know you have to go. It's exactly the time your amazing assistant told us to wrap it up.
Yeah. Well, let me just close. I have a website that I populate for physicians and scientists. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's unbranded. It's just pure science. It's mushroomreferences.com.
Okay. We put that in show notes.
You can look up all the psilocybin studies or most all of them. Mm-hmm. You can put in lion's mane. You can put in Alzheimer's. You can put in virus. It's very good searchable. And you can see some of the best articles that have been published in scientific peer-reviewed literature. Because what my job is so much is educating physicians who don't have much time. They need to quickly get to the best data to be able to form an educated opinion. The biggest problem I've had is physicians who are uneducated. Mm-hmm. So when physicians say this stuff is bullshit, it doesn't work, medicinal mushrooms have no value, I like to say, show me your publications on medicinal mushrooms. I didn't know you were an expert in this subject.
Yeah.
Of course, they have none. Right.
Sure.
So, but rather than being insulting, but sometimes I've had to have some bravado because of, that's the way it is. But more importantly, mushroomreferences.com has a lot of excellent material for researchers and physicians. And then my personal website, also not branded, is paulstamets.com. Mm-hmm. You can see many of the articles I've published in the scientific literature. And I just want to close that we are at the threshold of a paradigm shift in the evolution of our consciousness and the evolution of the human species. It is important for us to wake up at a time critical to engage nature, to be able to support the biodiversity, the multi-ethnicity, and the ability for all of us to work together for a better future. And I think that these psilocybin molecules are the spark to be able to cause the neurogenesis that's needed for us to do this.
Okay. Well, I have one last question about a lion's mane. So if I want to have like a focus microdose for a day, like that I take on a daily basis, how would that look like?
Well, the lion's mane mycelium causes neurogenesis. The lion's mane mushrooms inhibit it.
Okay.
So it's not the mushrooms that contributed to neurogenesis. It's the lion's mane mycelium. There are several reports on this. We've also proved this in the laboratory. So make sure you take certified organic lion's mane mycelium grown on grain. We found that the grain is fermented, and the fermented grain has powerful properties. It's like, you know, milk is not a filler for yogurt. Yogurt is fermented milk. So the grain is fermented by the lion's mane mycelium and produces this huge repertoire of extremely interesting and complementary immunologically beneficial compounds. So 500 milligrams to a gram of lion's mane mycelium grown on grain, and then you stack it with the psilocybin mushroom of your choice, again, to make sure it is below the threshold of any noticeable effect, so you're not getting intoxicated.
Yeah.
And then if you go to microdose.me, we have tap tests,
yeah, we have memory
tests, we have hearing tests, we have vision tests, and you can chart whether this has had an influence on you positively or negatively over time. So microdose.me has the way of you measuring whether you're having any positive or negative effects.
Perfect. I will do that. And then we're all going to be like a little Einstein community, I guess, hopefully. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I know you're a super busy person, and I'm super excited that you've done this. And thank you very much. It's super interesting. And again, like, we could go on for, of course, for the next 10 hours, but
longer
this is
than
just
that.
A little podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Have a great day, and enjoy your Friday. I think it's...
Okay, Anna, you didn't tell me what country you're from. Where
Germany.
You
Germany.
You're from Germany. Okay. My last name, Stamets, was Steinmetz.
Really? Oh, my God. All these Germans. And why is it Stamets?
Well, let me tell you, I'm going to go over, but I have a few more minutes. Yeah. But let me tell you a great story, and I have the record of this. I have a letter from 1821 that was retyped on a typewriter in 1883. Philip Steinmetz grew up in Bavaria, and in the 1700s, like 1750, he was the sole son of his parents, who were very wealthy, had many thousands of acres of this giant estate. He grew up in royalty. But Philip Steinmetz got in a fight with his father when he was about 17, and he ran away. He went to France. He was hungry, so he killed a deer, but it was on the king's property. So he was thrown into prison. He and two of his colleagues broke out of prison, jumped on a ship, and went to America. And so he landed in Virginia around 1760. He became part of the Revolutionary War movement to oppose the Brits, the British.
Yeah.
A lot of German mercenaries were being hired by the British to fight the revolutionary people. So they anglicized his name from Steinmetz to Stamets, because they didn't want to be associated with German mercenaries. Now the story gets better. And so the commandant in the fields, the British field fort in Virginia, fell in love with my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. And in the report that I had, he vanquished every American he challenged to a duel. So this British officer was renowned at picking fights, having duels, and killing Americans, the revolutionary Americans. So he challenged my grandfather, and they flipped a coin to choose the weapon. And my grandfather chose swords on horseback.
Oh, my God.
The British commandant didn't realize that he was trained in Germany as German royalty. And this is something he grew up doing. You know, he was very, very skilled.
Yeah.
So in the town square, facing the British commander and my great-grandfather on horseback, with my grandmother in the audience and all the soldiers and the town people, they charged each other. And my grandfather, Philip Steinmetz, beheaded the British general and literally grabbed my grandmother and rode out of town. And okay. That's why I'm here today.
Wow. Okay. That's so interesting. So have you ever been to Bavaria then?
I went. There's two towns in Germany. It's confusing. There's two towns with the very same name. I could send it to you. Yeah. But and then in 1840 or something, the mm-hmm. German, the at that time, what was the German government, because there was no inheritors to this estate, they sent over lawyers to find the next of kin, the next descendants. And by the time the letters made it to my great-great-grandfather and mother, the German government nationalized the property. So some big park in Germany was my family's estate. And back then it was worth $16 million were in the inheritance, which I calculate out to about $4 billion today. So,
oh my God, that's getting more and more interesting.
I'm entitled to $4 billion somewhere in Germany.
Sounds good to me. So if anything goes wrong in America, you just come to Germany.
Anyhow, I'll go ahead and I'll send you this letter. It's a real, maybe you can track down, you know, what.
Yeah, we find them. If it's 4 billion, I'm up for it to find them.
All right. Thank you, Miles.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Right.
Talk to you soon.